I've been recording all the talks that I've been doing, and this one is no exception. So I'm recording this one as well, and somebody's capturing it on video too, so we're being redundant as well. I'm always interested when people do introductions, because I get up here and I always want to respond to the introduction and forget about the talk that I had planned. And talks like this always intimidate me. I'll be quite upfront with that right off the bat, because I'm sometimes touted as an expert in e-learning, a guru in e-learning, and I kind of try to look the part a little. But, nobody is more aware than me, because I'm the person standing here, that there's a whole lot more expertise in this room over there than there is up here on this stage. And so it's always difficult to kind of get into the flow of things, because I know that I'm talking to people who actually know more about this than I do. You all certainly know more about Tasmania. Many of you will know a great deal more about things like economic development, positioning Tasmania, and things like that. I'm a different sort of person. My education is in philosophy, so I'm a philosopher, which should actually frighten you. And I have expertise in technology. I'm a technologist and so on. And I come at this subject from a very, as was just said, non-bureaucratic point of view. When I was found and dragged kicking and screaming, from Strawn, they found me with my head poked in a forest, leaning over, so you know which end of me they saw, taking that photograph. And I was just getting ready for this session, I was thinking, well, I do have an overall theory, so I can talk about the role of government, the role of business, and the role of education, and all of that sort of stuff. And the overall theory, well, something like that expresses it as well as anything else. And the model that I bring to technology, the model that I bring to learning, is also the model that I bring to government and to economics and finance and things like that. They won't let me near Wall Street with this model, but that's okay. So what we've got, you probably see it in your things, we've got four sessions today. The role of business. The role of government first. Interesting to put government first, but we'll leave that aside. The role of government, the role of business, the role of education, and then a mishmash on future directions. Now, it's the mishmash on future directions which is the least structured, where I'll have the most fun. But we sort of have to move there in stages. So through each of these sessions, I'm going to talk for a little bit. As those of you who were at my session Friday will recall, we got into a lot better content when there was no script, there was no organization, where things were really dynamic, where there was an interplay with the group and myself, and that was a lot more fun. So, as the thing says, I'll talk for a little bit, and then we'll get into the discussion. We've got Phil Donahue-style microphones here. At least there's one of them. You guys have Phil Donahue here, or had it, right? Yeah, good. I have to check these things. I really am a fish out of water. Anyhow, so I'll talk for about 25 minutes, about 20 now for this first session, and then we'll move into the discussion. I will say, this is your session. This isn't my session. And that's important to me. I have things I want to say. I have, theories I want to put forward and all of that. And no doubt, because you're here, you want to hear them. But if you want to change the direction, if you don't like what I have to say, if there's a question you have, you want something drawn out, interrupt. Stop me. Change the direction. Tell me to throw away the slides. I'd be happy to do that. I'm not wedded to these slides. I'm not wedded to this plan. We have an organization all structured out. It's beautiful. We do have lunch at a certain time, so we have to stop then. But if we throw out the book and go off in a different direction, that's not going to bother me. So as a group, you should feel free to guide me in this session. This is your session, not my session. All of that said, Positioning Tasmania as a leader in ICT-enabled education and training. Now, anyone who knows me knows I didn't write this title. So let's start by questioning it. Our education and training the future, I mean, is that even the objective? I've talked quite a bit about what it is that we're up to when we're up to a whole business of teaching. One of the slogans that I've used, I actually sort of came up with the wording for it in Brisbane or someplace like that, or Canberra even. It's not about us providing education and training for students. It's about us enabling students to provide learning for themselves. So the shift here is in the from us doing things for people to people doing things for themselves. We'll find that as a theme that runs throughout what I want to say here. So education and training, I would probably drop those words and probably replace them with learning or something like that. Another assumption, and this one gets more to the heart of this session. Sorry, I don't mean to be saluting you. It's just I've got a bright light there, and I'm trying to see you because they've designed a distance here. I find that very fascinating. And then they've designed a bright light and a bright background. I can see you, sort of. And like when I talk, I really depend on this interaction. Which is why I'm here. Otherwise, you know, I mean, I could have done this from Canada, but then I wouldn't see you react, and I wouldn't have the capacity to go off on irreverent asides like this one, just to explain things. You don't need to fix anything. Please don't fix things. I'm fine. I'm just explaining why my hand is doing that. And that's mostly for the video camera, because they will have no idea. Is it possible to be a leader in this? We were talking about this last night. And I've been thinking about this quite a bit, because what does it mean to be a leader in education and training? I mean, let's face it, education and training is a worldwide industry. Even internet or ICT-enabled education and training is a worldwide industry. From where I sit, it's going to be impossible for any jurisdiction really to become a leader in a field or a domain or a discipline that is already well entrenched around the world. It's like saying, let's make Tasmania a leader in auto production and ignoring what's happening in Detroit and Japan and Italy. It's like saying, let's make Tasmania a leader in, oh, I don't know. That's all the only example I have. But you know what I mean. Leadership doesn't come from doing what people have already done elsewhere. Leadership comes from doing what hasn't been done elsewhere. And so this title here is telling me we're going to be leaders by emulating what has been done in this place, that place, the other place. And people spoke to me specifically of New Brunswick. New Brunswick did become a leader, but what it did is it created in the province a capacity that did not exist in most other jurisdictions at the time. That's a one-time thing for that capacity. You can only do it once. You can only be the first to do it once. So as we're sitting here thinking about this, I think there ought to be some rethinking of the goals and the objectives here. I think it's admirable and important to want to be a leader, but being a leader, this is going to entail being a leader in something new. And that's going to be your job to decide. I'm not going to be able to come here and say, oh, you should be a leader in this because no one else is doing it. I mean, there's lots of things nobody else is doing, but I go around to everyone saying, oh, yeah, you should do this. So, I mean, part of what I'll talk about in a little bit is the Tassie experience. And I'm asking the question, I have been asking the question, I asked the question, why do I come back here? What makes Tasmania unique? What is it Tasmania could do uniquely that nobody else could do? And that's where the leadership is going to come from. Similarly, I ask what's implied by the concept of positioning. I'm going to take up my whole 25 minutes talking about the topic, but that's okay. It'll be the first time I've ever been on topic. Because the idea of positioning entails the idea that again, we will do something for you. Right? It's sort of like, you know, a management perspective, or again, a bureaucratic perspective, right? We're going to organize ourselves in such a way as to, and I don't think it'll work that way. Another theme that I will come back to on a number of occasions through this talk is that innovation doesn't come from the top. Never has. Innovation comes from the bottom. That's why it's important. I did do some research on this and went through government sites and stuff. And I saw it a lot, the idea that there has to be consultation and connection with the people who are being served by the various departments. You see that over and over and over again. And the reason for that, because they never say the reason, right? The reason for that is that's where the ideas are. That's where the innovation is. And, ultimately, that's where the capacity has to be built. So, questioning assumptions. I mean, the underlying assumption behind all of this is economic development, jobs for all, becoming a world leader and all that. So I thought of examples. And, of course, New York springs to mind. And I'm asking myself, well, is this what Tasmania is striving for? I can't answer that question. My guess would be no. You'd need about, 7.5 million more people, at least in this city. Maybe another 10 million in the immediate environment. I won't think about what that would do for the sheep farms, but... I mean, there are different ways of having development. There are different ways of looking what it is to become a leader, a world leader in anything. And one way is through size and scale. And that's usually the way that people think of, right? Let's have more. Let's have more economic development, more capacity building, more people, more jobs, so on and so forth. And that's what you get. But then there are other ways. There are small ways. And my thinking is that the small ways are probably more appropriate to Tasmania. I don't have my other note. I have crib notes somewhere, but I lost them. So I've forgotten what the exact thing was that I wrote, but it's economic, something like economic development on a scale appropriate to Tasmania. Now that does not mean, it doesn't even mean small in a certain sense, and it doesn't mean backwards in any sense. But it means that, you know, things like massive auto plants, huge downtowns, things like that, probably are neither appropriate or desired. But again, this is your decision to make. And I'm drawing it out here. I'm trying to draw out what sort of assumptions are implicit behind the concept of development. Because there isn't just one kind of development. And the issues are yours to resolve. With that, I'll get to my talk. How much does anyone actually keeping track of time? Oh, you are. Good. Can you do something like when I have 5 minutes left, and that way I'll be able to get through the remaining 80% of my remarks? This is very typical of my talks, and for those, like many of you who are aware of me and aware of my newsletter are probably aware that I will do this. I'll drift off because my topics bounce around. Somebody described my other talk, the one I think last Friday is hypertext discussion. That's about right. I don't move in a linear fashion. There are many reasons why I don't move in a linear fashion. Mostly because I can't, because that assumes a single strand of thought, and I don't usually have that. So anyhow, we were thinking about this, tried to pull out the role of government, came up with four major things. And as I was looking, excuse me, I need a caffeine break. I also tried to warn people, I'm not good at morning sessions, but nobody's been listening to me. I picked four things almost at random: vision, infrastructure, exemplar, and networking. These are neither exhaustive. They're not exhaustive. There are other things. They're not definitive. They're just four topics. Again, they'll work around a bit of a theme here. And as I was looking through the Tasmanian government pages and things like that, I found that a lot of this stuff is already covered, which is good. For example, the vision, and here's the vision that I pulled off of one of the pages here. Together we will make Tasmania an icon for the rest of the world by creating a proud and confident society where our people live in harmony and prosperity. I found that good, but I found it vague, and it's particularly with respect to education, because it doesn't speak to education, although harmony and prosperity are, in my mind, inextricably linked with education. So I went digging a bit deeper, and on the same site, out of the various goals that were listed, we were able to find two of them that pertain to education. One of them was create a culture that encourages people to learn and develop new skills, including life skills, throughout their lives. And ensure education and training provides our workforce with the skills to support our business and industry. And these were from the 24 goals. And these were the ones that spoke specifically to education. And now I began to worry a little bit. And as you see the question mark there, the emphasis seems to be on skills. And that tells me that the driver here in the description of this vision, of these goals, is an economic driver. That education is seen as a means of economic development. That is very different from my approach to education. And so I was kind of concerned, well, maybe I'm talking to the wrong group. Because education, although it plays a role in economic development, the purpose of education is not itself economic development, in my view. A system of society and learning, where each person is able to rise to his or her fullest potential without social or financial encumbrance, where they may express themselves fully and without reservation through art, writing, athletics, invention, or even through their avocations or lifestyle. It's the funniest thing. There was a thing came out, a study came out, and I haven't run it yet, Noel Daly, so I haven't read it in depth, but I've read the overviews. A study from Cardiff said, and the Register in its classic style summarized it, despite technology, people are still thick. And the gist of the study was that we've got all this technology, billions, and it says Carl Sagan, billions and billions of dollars worth of technology, and yet, you know, the numbers of people attending online learning institutions hasn't gone up. And in fact, it turns out that the same predictors for uptake in online learning, the same predictors for learning in general, social economic background, are good predictors for online learning. The people who would have gone to university do it online. The people who wouldn't have, as the Register says, stay thick. Which is, to me, to completely misunderstand the concept. Again, in their usual sardonic way, the Register describes it as, instead of applying themselves and taking online courses, people are doing things like pursuing their hobbies and music. And my reaction is, perfect. That's how it should work. Right? The driver for an education isn't an economic driver. It's a personal driver. The ideal, and if you want to tie it to economics, the ideal job, the ideal career, is one that grew out of your hobbies. Or maybe being in a rock band, one or the other. So it's the interests, the desires, the empowerment of the individual which drives education, rather than the needs of society, and especially the economic sector of society. You might think, well, I'm just throwing economics to the wind. But my view is the economic stuff will come out of that. And it'll come out of that in a more natural manner. And flowers become flowers by doing what flowers do, not what forests want them to do. Okay, so I was sort of disheartened, but then I went to another link. Tasmania will have a world-class education, training, and information system which matches the best anywhere. No problem with that. Sounds good. Well, except for the training part. But you know, I mean, training isn't bad. It's just the connotation, right? I mean, people need to be trained, but it's you know, I mean, you think of the concept of the sports team where they have to have a trainer and a coach in it. So it's just, you know, it's just me reacting to connotations rather than specific concepts and words. This part I like. All people have a fair go and are able to access high-quality services. There were some qualifications, but I just dropped those. To me, this is basic. All people have a fair go. I have another slide. Access, access, access. Key. And finally, we get to the part where Tasmania and I truly converge, and probably the reason why I want to keep coming back here. We recognize that a truly democratic and civil society has its roots in the education we can provide. Or, well, even that we can provide isn't quite right. But we'll leave that aside. There is, in my mind, an inextricable link between democracy, between freedom, between civil society and education. And it's the first and foremost duty of government to recognize that, to clearly state that, and to make that its ultimate aim. We were talking yesterday about the role of government. And the role of government with respect to economic development and education and so on. And all of these other things, the development, the industry, the prosperity of the people, the health of the people, the lifespan of the people, the quality of life, these things all flow out of education. And I was thinking, you know, people are going to say, yeah, I'm going to emphasize education because I'm in this field. Something that's kind of a natural. But my response to that was, no, that's not right. Because I could have done many things with my life. I'm in this field because of the importance of education. And that's where I think all of these other things flow from. So there is, despite my earlier criticisms, I think an alignment between the vision that Tasmania has and the vision that I have. And what's important is to draw that out and make that clear. Second major, I'm probably down to 5 minutes by now. No? Good. Second major aspect of the role of government is in the provision of infrastructure. The economic reason behind that is there's no money in infrastructure. People don't get rich building roads. You know, some people have gotten rich building phone systems, but by and large, it's not really a money maker, and especially in the early days. You know, when you had to run phone lines out to Strawn, I can just imagine somebody running a phone line up to Strawn. I mean, that wasn't a big money maker. And the same thing with information and communication technology. When you're looking at providing access on a broad scale, this isn't going to make a lot of money for you. Ringtones, yes, that will make money for you. A little money. In Canada, we did three major things. I think we did three major things. Other people will say, well, we did five major things or whatever. First thing we did is we built the world's fastest backbone. The backbone is like the Trans-Canada Highway. It's the core of the internet in our country. It's called CANET. And we're up to CANET 4. And you know, you may hear from time to time remarks about the United States Internet 2 and so on. Well, that's roughly equivalent to CANET 3. CANET 4 is by far and away the fastest backbone in the world. It's not even close. That's why when they do these internet land speed records, right, they always do it like continent to continent. That way it has to go through the United States. So the backbone's been very important for us. For me, internet access to a Canadian site is almost instantaneous, and this has allowed for the practical application, the practical distribution of a wide range of products and services. The primary use, ironically, I read this in a study just recently. I don't have a reference here. I'm sorry, but it's somewhere. Primary use for the internet in New Brunswick is access to healthcare services. Go figure. Who would have thought? it's not music or hobbies, but some people think it's important. That's not possible without fast, dependable, always-on access. If it were me, if I were running Tasmania, I would make that a priority. Especially after, you know, I've been doing the dial-up thing. It's hard. You have to have the highways, or at the very least roads, but you have to have this. Second thing, and I was very pleased to learn that Tasmania has already been doing this. In Canada, we had a very successful and very widespread program called Community Access Program, or Community Access Points. And that's simply the provision of access to the internet in every community in the country. And what was important in Canada was that these community access points served not only as a place for the community to connect to the internet, they also served as a place for the community to connect with itself. The community access points were locally run. Government funded them, and basically what would happen is the government would say to the communities, put together a proposal. Tell us where you're going to put the computers, how you're going to manage the access point, things like that. Now, they'd come up with a plan. And we're not going to run these access points for you. We're going to give you the funding to get them off the ground, but you're going to run them. And all we want to know is how you're going to run them, what the impact of these things will be. So, to me, the important thing wasn't the internet access itself. The important thing was the centering of the community around this access point so that people in the community understood in a clear way that this is a community resource and something that needs to be shared by the people across the community. Over time, this is almost sort of history now. Over time, access to the communities has grown in more direct ways. There's a project called Alberta SuperNet, for example. The purpose of Alberta SuperNet is to do much the same, except in a very fiber broadband way, as the community access points. And again, the idea is to connect every community in the province, all the schools, all the hospitals, all the municipal buildings, and so on, to broadband. And they're well underway with that. And there have been a lot of offshoots for it because, of course, the government said to themselves, okay, now we've built this network, we really should put something on it. And that's how a lot of the online education initiatives in Alberta came about. Broadband-enabled learning, for example, the Bell project was a good example of something you put on Alberta SuperNet. But it makes sense, right? Because once you have the highway, then you need to be thinking about the sort of traffic that's going to run on it. I do like the highway analogy. Other people don't like the highway analogy, but I think it makes a lot of sense. The final thing, and again I see that Tasmania has undertaken this, is the provision of services on the internet. The paradigm example is, of course, Service New Brunswick. And I found it was interesting that Service Tasmania has a very similar name. So having important information and services on that network is the third infrastructure role for government. Now I'm curious. Because, you see, when you're talking to people, you always key in on someone. I was keying in on him. And now he's over there saying, get him off the stage. I've got 10 minutes, okay. So now I'm all flustered. That's okay. We'll get into the good stuff later. So some issues that came to my mind. The question of whether he's back. is infrastructure access only? And sometimes it's presented as that, right? So, you know, build a road and they will travel or something like that. But I don't think it is, because the internet is a little bit different from the highway system in the sense that we require not just the highway, but the vehicles to run on the highway, the destinations to go to on the highway, and so on. And if we look at education in particular, and again, I'm still thinking of the role of government here and asking what constitutes an educational infrastructure. What are the basic things we have to put into place? What are the things in which there isn't really any money to be made? The major things are access to learning materials, the content, the online encyclopedias, or as I say these days, the online Wikipedias. Learning objects, properly so-called, things like that. There have been a lot of effort in Canada with respect to content. One of the major projects that we have in Canada, one that I support very strongly, is called SchoolNet. And SchoolNet has some absolutely fabulous resources on it. If you do a Google search, you'll find SchoolNet. For example, the Media Awareness Network of SchoolNet has been winning awards on a regular basis for both the breadth and the quality of its content. And this is the sort of, just me being cynical, media awareness isn't really the sort of thing we can expect from commercial publishers and media outlets and so on. So it's just the sort of thing that's suitable for a government agency such as SchoolNet to be putting online. Fabulous program. Access to software and services. There was much discussion, and I guess there are political issues, which I won't touch on, because I don't want to get involved in Tasmanian politics or election issues, but access to software and services, I think, are important. If there are things that are needed for the conduct of learning online, and then it seems to me that it's an important part of the role of government to make sure that these things are made available. And by made available, we go back to the original slide, made available to everybody, to all of the learners in the state, and by implication to those organizations and institutions that are involved in learning. Now, just exactly what counts as the necessary software and services, I think, is open to some discussion. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when I start talking about the role of education, because to me, access to software and services does not mean a learning content management system for everyone or SAP for all. That's not what I mean by that. But there are certain minimal standards. I don't even want to say it that way. How do I want to say it? Pardon?
Protocols.
Yeah. But that's not what I mean either, because I'm trying to say there are certain minimal configurations, suites of software, applications, web browsers, for example, would be an example. Everybody in the state should have access to a web browser. Happily, those are available for free already, but if they weren't, then it would become a primary responsibility. And then finally, I say finally only because it's third on the list. Pardon? Thank you. Access to instruction, mentoring, and coaching. And I'm not saying anything new here when I say that a government should provide access to instruction, mentoring, and coaching. Of course, the trick is, in our context of delivery online, access to online instruction, mentoring, and coaching. So that's not so easy to pull off, but I nonetheless think that it's essential and important. There is this belief somewhere out in the educational community, or maybe the technology community, but if you just put a bunch of materials online, you've done the job, you've provided online learning. And I know I'm speaking to educators here, and I'm seeing a lot of nods around the room. Education isn't just the provision of educational materials. It is also access to those very important human supports behind that. And by human supports, I came up with a thing once many, many years ago I called the triad model. And it's probably not original to me. Nothing is original to me. The idea that if you have a person in a remote community, a remote learner, if you will, that person is going to access instructional support both in the local community and at a distance. The person in the local community who works with this student, this learner, I have always represented as being something like a mentor, a coach, or things like that. But more importantly, the local support for the student on this model acts as an advocate and a representative of the student vis-a-vis the rest of the world, rather than as a representative of the agencies that are providing learning. This sort of coach or mentor helps the student interact with these remote agencies, helps the student define their own goals, helps the student with work-study habits, or whatever it is that is needed in order to successfully access this learning and training from the remote regions. The remote instructors may be based anywhere, they may be in any discipline, they're probably from a multiple institutions, and that's why it's very important to have a person in the local community clearly and unambiguously on the student's side, not in an evaluative role, not in an assessment role, but in a support and coaching role. I think that's crucial. So, in a very real sense, ironically, providing access to learning online means providing resources, human resources, in remote communities. Some of my most influential moments as an educator were traveling throughout northern Alberta, and it was very clear to me and very obvious to me that in the villages and towns and the First Nations reserves that I visited, where they had this dedicated personnel, that's where the successes were happening, and where these people were missing, so was the learning. Finally, and this gets talked about a lot, so I'm not going to linger on it for a long time, is the idea of government as exemplar. Canada's going through this whole, I mean, we just went through an election, which was lots of fun, a lot like your election. Votes and platforms and all and so on. But I'm assuming, but I'll bet you I'm right. In our election, anyways, what happened is, before the election, the run-up to the election, everything came to a stop. And all the different institutions and agencies and projects sat there and waited for the next round of funding. And the next round of funding would not come until after the election, right? So you had to have, so it's like the election hiatus. And pretty well, lots of people got laid off, and projects were sort of, trying to find bridge funding for them. EduSource, big, huge, national, Canadian infrastructure initiative, $10 million project, stopped for the period of the election. The election is over now, and so we move into the next natural state of the political process, that's planning. Even though we had the same government after as before, we're still going through a planning round. And I'm cynical, but you need to do that, obviously. It'd be really silly to do stuff without planning. And one of the big pushes in the current planning round, because there's been a lot of talk and a lot of funding for e-learning in Canada, but not a lot of use and uptake. And so the message that's coming to government is, we need you to model the use of these services. We need, just in the way you've modeled the use of other things in the past, like, personnel management software and so on and so forth. And, we have Corel based in Ottawa. So, Industry Canada modeled that by using WordPerfect instead of Microsoft Word, which I thought was a courageous decision. And then they sold Corel to American Interest, so that kind of ended that. But that's the sort of thing I mean. And so what needs to happen in government is an explicit adoption of e-learning as a strategy within the organization, where it's understood that learning opportunities will be made available to staff at all level through information and communication technology. And I have no doubt that some of this is already available, but it needs to be explicitly stated as a goal, as an objective. It needs to have the support at the highest level, in our case, the premier level or the prime ministerial level, and it needs to percolate all the way down so that everybody on staff is accessing learning through information and communication technology. And the neat thing is, It's not simply, I'll come to this in the next section, it's not simply because, great, now we'll provide customers for all of our ICT businesses. This has nothing to do with it. The neat thing here is if the government is actually using the technology that it's promoting, then the government understands in a direct way, rather than through experts and consultants, what works and what doesn't work. I've been saying for many years that setting up pre-structured 40-hour courses with lessons and all of that is not the way to go in e-learning. But you can't know this until you try it, and you try it and you realize, oh, well, this didn't really work for me. It worked a little. I mean, we do know it sort of works, but it's not really a very efficient way to learn, and a lot of what was learned wasn't really what I needed to know in my job. And if government staff are employing e-learning in a direct, immediate way on their job, that allows them to refine the concept for themselves, pick out the sorts of learning that works and the sorts of learning that doesn't work. I say this from the perspective of, in my own case, deliberately providing what I think is the alternative to e-learning than that typically thought of. You've seen my website, I assume. How many of you have seen my website? More than half. The rest of you should go to it. Nothing like a little self-promotion here. My website is an explicit exemplar of online learning. But it contains no courses, no classes. It does not have a cohort. It does not have a start date or an end date. But I believe that it is for the people who do subscribe to it, probably the most valuable e-learning tool that they use. And let's test that empirically. We saw the roughly how many hands went up for people who've been to my website. How many of you would agree with the statement that I've just made? Let's just say an important rather than the most important. This is not a competition. How many of you would say it's an important form of learning or education in your jobs today? Well, not quite as many. Isn't that interesting? But still a good representation. So, I don't know, it looked like about 20 hands or so went up in this group. So, there is a sense in which the non-structured, non-linear, non-formal learning is, in fact, the kind of e-learning that's most appropriate in the workplace. J. Cross, just yesterday or Friday or whatever, talked about learning improvisation, doing it on the fly. And his observation was, that's what most people's jobs are these days, and that's what most people's learning needs to be these days. That's the sort of thing you can only get through direct experience with the technology. And you may come out of it disagreeing with me, and that's fine, but you'll be doing that from a position of knowledge and experience with the technology itself. And to me, that's the most important thing. So that ends the first segment of it. So we're going to move now to, and I'll probably right on time, more or less, move to the discussion. Let's just do that. And I want a nice, neat, snappy closing sentence. It's just not there.
Thanks, David, for that. I'd like to introduce Janine Byer, the Principal Instruction Officer with the Department of Education, and Janine's going to facilitate discussion.
Thanks, Janine. Thanks. We've got a roving microphone, so please, at the back, so please take questions now for Stephen.
Oh, it's even warm. Am I showing signs of caffeine deprivation?
No.
Thanks.
Questions? I think you've got to make them, Stephen.
Well, look, if you don't talk, I'm going to launch into a discussion of flowers and philosophy and networks and ecosystems. So,
Stephen, I've got one. You had 4 points, and your last one was networking, which I don't think you quite got to.
You're right. But I have another slide, don't I? That's what happens when I'm a little intimidated, and that's okay. See? No questions, more talk. Just very briefly, I mean, because I'm sort of mixed opinions on this, but the role of government. I'm going to talk more about, see, I'm keep centering myself because it's coming later and I don't want to do it all right now, but the networking function is incredibly important for government. Let me reword that. Government is, I don't know what I want to say. I mean, because it's been a big thing for the Canadian government, and you can see the examples up there on the screen, EduSpecs with our representatives at IMS and so on. I've also spilled coffee on myself, so I'm trying to position myself behind my screen here. And I think they're important, but I can't articulate why I think they're important, if that makes sense. Networking is important inherently. I am less convinced of the value of high-level networking. I think it may be important to a higher levels, but I don't live at those levels. And from my perspective, it's sort of a little bit maybe marginally important. I think it's nice that we have people sitting on these bodies and boards, but it's not necessarily clear to me exactly how that is filtering to the rest of us. That may be a question of how we're implementing it. It may be just a question of me feeling left out. So that's why I'm humming and hawing here. You're getting like raw content now. Because I'm on the one sense trying to promote the importance of this, but I'm on the other sense not convinced of it. And that's hard to do. Especially these particular bodies because, you know, I mean, I have other talks where I talk about, you know, the standards process and all of that. And we have these three standard processes and all of that, but the standards processes that are, in my mind, really the ones that are actually working are the ones that don't have any standards bodies, don't have this higher level networking, aren't trying to tell us, okay, here's how it's going to be. So networking, to me, plays a role as a good way of exchanging information, ideas, things like that. Making sure that you know what's going on, and that's why I say having a seat at the table is the important thing. But from the point of view of coming up with these standards or formulating the policies and things like that, my own view is that it's less important. So, honestly, the topic of discussion of these meetings is, in my mind, and I may be unique here, almost irrelevant. Now, they wouldn't think that they would completely disagree with me, right? IMS irrelevant, SCORM irrelevant. But the actual talking that takes place, the getting to know each other that takes place at these meetings, that's what's important. The content is just the filler. It's the communication channel that's important. It's the creation of what small worlds theorists would say are the long, random connections between local area networks. So it's the bridging of gaps between cultures. That's the value of these networks, and not the determination of standards or the specification of what it is that we're all going to do in combination. I was better off when I skipped that slide.
Just a question in relation to training, as you put it. Mm-hmm. I dare say, firstly, an explanation why there is an emphasis on training is that politically we're funded to provide training, and that's generally done through the TAFE system in Australia.
Right.
And then you make reference to education and training is best directed by the person themselves, which I don't disagree with. But within our political structure, we have things such as training packages, which have been determined by industry bodies with little involvement of the people. How as a training provider, but we do cling very dearly to our education and training provider because we do consider ourselves educators, how do we wrestle with that within providing sound education and training to best students?
It's kind of like saying, given that we are between a rock and a hard place, how do we... I mean, yeah, and we see this in Canada too, and there's this belief, which I think in my mind is a bit of a mythology, that industry can direct training. And it's ironic because the very same people in industry will tell government not to direct industry. I have a slide on that a little bit now. Industry will tell you, and they will be largely correct in telling you, that with some few exceptions, the marketplace is the best, most accurate, and most efficient means of allocating priorities and, in some cases, resources. Now, there are exceptions to that, and it's in the margins that we find the distinctions between capitalism and socialism. But by and large, the view of the organization of the economy and resources in society that we've adopted in the Western world is one where decisions are made at the local level by those who are most impacted by the decision. Now, I happen to agree with that. And again, there are exceptions at the margins, and we can talk about those if that becomes necessary. And the reason why this is the case is that you cannot, at a central level, take into account all of the information, all of the variables, all of the parameters involved in making economic decisions. It's simply not possible. It doesn't matter how smart the person is who's sitting at the top of the food chain. That person simply is not humanly able to take into account all of the variables. I was thinking, I didn't do a slide. I know. Sometimes my best ideas are forgotten. But I was thinking about this when I was thinking more in the next section. We're sort of prefacing into the next section, so I'm going to find myself without stuff to talk about, but very well. Look at the manufacturer of a 747. Nobody knows how to make a 747, particularly how to make one fly. And actually, I stand at airports, I look at them, there's no way. You know, it's too big. The wings aren't big enough. It cannot fly. And then this thing slowly, ponderously, very ponderously, gets itself off the ground. And once again, I am proven wrong. But no one person knows how to do this. You think about it. Particularly, you know, there may be people who know how to design a 747, and they may even know how to fly them. They certainly do not know how to refine petroleum and create aircraft fuel. They certainly do not know how to set up a tool and die plant to make rivets. Right? The knowledge of how to build a 747 is distributed across society. It would therefore be absurd to put in the hands of one person the knowledge, the direction of how to build a 747. It couldn't be done. No person could have enough knowledge to successfully tell everybody involved in the construction, maintenance, and flight of a 747 what to do. Couldn't it? All you'd get is piles of stuff that doesn't actually fly. So, that's the marketplace theory of industry. And so when industry says government should not direct what industry does, industry is thinking of this sort of thing. And they are saying things like, we know our business best, and so on. And yet, somehow, magically, they become experts in learning. And they are able to tell the people, in this case of Tasmania, what it is that they ought to be studying for future success. It's absurd. They are no more experts in learning than I am an expert in building and flying a 747, or anyone for that matter. Just as decisions about economics or 747 must be distributed across society, so also decisions about learning must be distributed across society. And the proof of this, in my observation, is the consistency with which industry gets it wrong. How many times have you seen, and I know I've seen this in my country, how many times have you seen industry one year say, we need 5,000, or not 5,000 ever, but 500 speech pathologists. And we go through enormous expense, and people, individuals, bet their career on this training, and a few years later they come out as speech pathologists. And then we find, well, really, there was only funding for 45 positions. And I don't know what happens here, but in Canada, the rest of them go to Texas. One of our major exports to the United States, you know, teachers, speech pathologists, medical professionals. It's an interesting thing. They come back eventually, having lived in the United States for a while. But still, the main point here is what industry thinks it needs is very different from what they actually need. I ran this slide. This was at the Canberra talk, so it's actually there somewhere. Industry has been for years saying, you know, people come out of our educational system that is very nice, you know, they have all of these general skills and so on and capacities, but, you know, they're not trained for working at our plant, at our institution. They don't have job-specific training. The knowledge they have isn't practical. I've been saying that for years. Then there was just the day before I did my talk in Canberra, I was sitting at a little cafe just outside the Department of Education, Science and Training and reading The Australian, which had in a nice section on education, which I thought was really nice. I mean, very nice of them to greet me to Australia by running a section covering all the major issues. And they did a little thing in that, talking about the new priorities of business, which turned out to be general skills, critical thinking, the ability to learn, all of the stuff that we had been teaching them and that the business was saying we were getting it wrong. And the point, in fact, is not to slam them. They might be as wrong this time as they were last time, but the point is the decisions about how to choose the educational directions of people need to be made at as local a level as possible. Again, like the marketplace, there are exceptions at the edges. But by and large, where possible, educational philosophy, educational directions ought to be distributed. People know for themselves, to a large degree, what they need to know and what they need to learn. And so when a government says, you know, okay, we're going to take direction from industry in order to determine what kind of training we need to offer, my view is that such a government is unnecessarily limiting the scope of input that it could have and is increasing the likelihood that it will make incorrect decisions about the allocation of training resources. And now I have no part two to my talk. Excuse me. So you got a little coffee and I get going. I always start slow. It's okay. Just checking to see how my sound's going. It's doing all right.
I'm very interested in the concept of government being an inventor and providing a notion of expanding the professional organisation, being a lean organisation, and there's a potential for innovating for industry to pick up on the notion of active learning, so when they recruit new people to active learning.
Can you speak up? I'm having a lot of trouble hearing you.
I'd like you to expand a little on the notion of government as an exemplar in learning and the major hurdles, because the economic return is not going to be realised through implementing online learning in government. And certification is unlikely because it's going to be as required as needed.
Okay, yeah, so there's no economic return to learning, and there's probably no certification either. And so that raises the question, well, what's the whole point? How do you justify government serving as an exemplar? And I will say, too, again, this is to assume part of the next section, and I've already mentioned this a wee bit, it's also not to provide good customers for local industry, software or content. So why would we bother? And I will tell you that because you know, I'm sure a lot of people came up with the counter argument right away. Oh, but there is economic incentive in learning. But you know, my view is that that's really hard to prove, and it's really hard to prove because people are not simple cause effect systems, and organizations are not simple cause effect systems, which means that sometimes if you put in an input at one end, that you don't get the output you expected at the other end. So there is not now, and probably never will be, a nice, neat observational correlation between providing training at one end and improving the profit margin at the other end. This is particularly the case in government, where if something turns out to be more efficient, then they spend the money elsewhere and they still run a deficit. No, I'm just kidding. But let me back off of that, because there was another aspect to your comments that didn't come through clearly in the summary, and that was the idea of people lacking specific knowledge or training that they need to do their job, either in government or in industry. And this leads to a contradiction that I've observed in quite a bit of the discussion of workplace training, because the idea of workplace training, including the government use of training in the workplace education, if you will, always seems to be to somehow meet the needs and the objectives of the organization in question. In other words, the only reason why a government would provide learning on the job was so that people could do their jobs better. But now, if we look especially at learning, the way it's evolving in the online era, the decisions about learning are becoming more and more taken by those who are actually doing the learning. And in fact, we have this whole dogma that we call learner-centered learning, where the whole idea is that the learner should direct the learning. So now we're trying to have it both ways here now, right? We've got the company or the government who's going to say, well, here's what you're going to learn. And on the other hand, we're trying to put control into the hands of the learner. And there's a contradiction, because it may not be the case that the learner's interest in learning aligns with the company's interest in learning. So, in my mind, the challenge of implementing e-learning, learning using information and communication technology in government, is not so much the use of the technology to provide job-specific skills and training, but rather in the government acquiring the will and the capacity to let go of the idea that it needs to direct and control this learning. That's a very hard thing to do, because you're paying for it. Right? And if you're paying for it, you think, well, I'm paying for this learning, you're taking word. You know, I'm paying for this learning, you're going to learn how to run SAP. It has zero job skills, there's zero job benefit, but you're going to learn how to do this. Because I'm paying for this, I want a return. But the return isn't in the learning. Right? The return is in the employee who acquires a greater benefit, a greater personal benefit, by working with that company or that organization. The benefit is that this person is overall someone who's acquired greater skills, capacities, attitudes, and so on, some of which may be directly related to the organization's mission and some of which may not be. In other words, you don't try to shape and mold and create an individual to meet your own needs and sort of fit as a cog in the place in the wheel. You create an environment in which people are able to increase or augment their own capabilities, their own capacities. That in itself will make them better employees, even though they're not necessarily learning the specifics that you would like them to learn now. And it comes back again to the setting of directions and centralized versus distributed control. Right? Is the manager more likely to be able to tell an employee exactly what sort of learning that they need to do in order to best do their job? Or are the group of employees able individually to determine for themselves what learning is needed for them to be the best or most capable people that they can become? Again, this is my philosophy thing coming out. Like, I demand consistency, at least a little consistency. And I hear over and over and over again, marketplace solution, free market, capitalism, and all that. Great, fine. Let's practice it in the workplace. Let's think of individual learners as autonomous learners. Now, implementing this in government will be hard because it's open-ended. I know, that it will produce better results in the end.
Thanks for that answer, Steve. Just to follow on from that, I guess the trend in the Australian training system at the moment would be to talk not so much in terms of learner-centred learning, but client-centred learning, where the client is defined equally as the employee and the employer, both of whom have legitimate interest in the outcomes of learning, so that a learning program is the product of a negotiation between a provider, an employee, and an employer.
Roll your pen.
And all have those sort of legitimate interests. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah. That's a great question. I'm just jotting a note. I wasn't ready for it, but right. Let's analyze this concept. All right. Let's go back, in fact. Well, no, okay, hang on. We'll go back to that in a moment. Let's look at this idea of client-centered learning. And the client-centered learning is the client is basically two people, right? The learner and the person or the group who's paying for the learning. Am I right? Okay. Now, and the assumption is, and it's a pretty reasonable assumption, right? If you put up the bucks, you have a say in the outcome, right? So far, so good. Now, how does this come to be the case? Right? Well, it comes to be the case because the learner in question would not have access to the learning unless the client paid the bucks, right? But now, I just got through doing a couple of slides talking about access for all a fair ago, right? You see, the client model of learning comes into play when learning as a resource is kept, I would argue artificially, scarce, thus forcing an economic payment up front in order for the learning to happen. If learning was truly accessible to all, the part of the client wouldn't need to pay and wouldn't have a say. So it's a little circle, isn't it? The client gets a say in the learning by fostering an environment in which learning is scarce. But that's exactly the opposite of the environment that we want. So I don't buy it. I don't buy the idea that the person who pays the money gets to call the tune. Not in this case, because the only reason money is required is because of a prearranged artificial scarcity. If that scarcity didn't exist, that person calling the tune would have utterly no rights under the sun to determine the direction of learning. So I say you can't have it both ways. You either say, we're going to promote access to learning for everyone, or you say, we're going to keep it an artificially scarce commodity to be used in order to compel learners to follow certain paths. One or the other. This is the philosophy in me. You can't have both. And the thing is, I will say this very clearly and forthright. People today are very aware, and they see this contradiction, and they know what's happening. And we get a lot of talk. We're still in the role of government, so I can say that. We get a lot of talk about the relevance of government and democracy in people's lives. This is one of the little things that never shows up in the press or anything like this. One of the little things that people see and they say, look at the contradiction. How is this relevant to me when the whole purpose of this whole government organization is to make it hard for me to learn what I want to learn? Right? To give the power and the control over my learning to my employer. That's where the skepticism comes from. And it comes when people say on the one hand, oh yeah, we're promoting access, but only if you take it our way and only if you give the employer his say in what you do. So I know that what I'm talking about here is a very different model from what's practiced today, and not just in Australia, but in my country as well, where we get all kinds of, you know, industry-sponsored initiatives and so on and so forth. You know, and it's so funny because, you know, the industry sponsoring the initiative, what the industry will do is apply for a government grant, get, you know, $250,000, say, great, I got $250,000 now, I'm going to pay for some training because I paid for it, I call the tunes. It all came from government money. So, I mean, look, it's a shell game, isn't it?
As opposed to the clients the learner wants versus the clients of the employer, in an ideal world, and perhaps one of the frustrating cases I've been thinking of in Tasmania, what you're thinking of the client as opposed to trying to make one make two, you're trying to end up with a cooperative arrangement where you have close enough arrangements that actually the learner understands the imperatives of the employer, just as the employer understands the imperatives of the learner, so that ultimately, in terms of the learner being self-driven, what they are doing is taking into account the needs, because maybe even if you have free access, there's an economic there in terms of time to go to training. If an employer is giving time, and quite frankly, I know we're talking about government at the moment, but in terms of industry, much of Tasmania is a small business, and time becomes an important element. And what you're saying is ultimately, if you get that total understanding all around, you get the engagement on the part of the learner to learn what the employer wants them to learn, as well as their own stuff that they're inherently interested in.
It's actually lunchtime.
Oh, okay.
Is it appropriate to deal with this question after lunch, or do you want to go for it now? Sorry, break time.
Yeah, okay, you scared me there. let me just deal with it briefly. Very briefly. I think you kind of... I always worry about questions that begin in the ideal world, because they're about to say that what I'm proposing is unrealistic. Although if you think about it, right, one person's ideal world is another person's reality. You know, I imagine from the point of view of business, you know, imagine in the ideal world, if I could get government to pay for my specific training needs, and if that wasn't the case, now you'd be sitting there saying, nah, that would never happen. It costs billions. But there you go. What you were saying, the learner understands the imperatives of the employer. We'll leave aside the word imperatives, because I don't believe in the idea of employers having imperatives and employees having what? Demands? I see the relationship of employer-employee in a very different light. I see that relationship as an exchange of mutual value. Now, we currently live in a society where if you are not employed, your life becomes very unpleasant and you possibly die because you need food to live and things like that. It's not so bad in modern industrial democracies such as Canada and Australia, where we'll just keep you at a very low standard of living. But, you know, outside of these countries, quite literally, you do die, and that creates this power imbalance. But that's shifting and that's changing. As power becomes more equitably distributed in society, so does the allocation of the wealth. And so, therefore, the balance between the employee and the employer begins to shift into something more like equity, where the relationship between employer and employee is no longer one of extortion, but one of mutual cooperation for mutual advantage. And it turns out, in my view, that that's a better model to run business anyways, because you're more likely to get better employees, happier employees, and more productive companies. In that model, it is to the advantage, obviously, of the employer to make it known to the employee what they should probably learn. And because it makes sense to be clear and open about what the requirements are in order to fulfill a particular position. I don't even want to say requirements, but you know what I mean. It is to the advantage of the employee to become of more value to the employer. Right, because that means that you can increase the exchange of mutual benefit. In practical terms, you might get a pay increase. You might get a longer vacation. You might get more freedom on your job. But the point here is that the model is cooperation and mutual exchange rather than command and control. So, if I understood your remarks correctly, and I believe I did, what you're saying is in the ideal world, we would be moving to that point where the interests of the employee and the interests of the employer coincide, they align. So the key here is we will never get to that point so long as there is this imbalance in the decision making, and we have to, the only way to get to this point is to understand that learning decisions are things ultimately made by the learner for the benefit of the learner, which then can be entered into as part of the mutual exchange of value between one autonomous entity and another. How's that? Okay. I really have no part two now.
We'll have to hold questions till after the break, but because we've come into the industry bit, the next session's slightly truncated, and I'm sure that'll work out fine. Joe, we'll make sure that doesn't get lost. It's 12 o'clock, and if we could have a short break now and be back in here at about 10 past to kick off with the next session.